Hey, this is Miles Fisher. Thanks for listening to Coffee with the Greats. Today, as we close out season two of this podcast, we're speaking with Dr. Condoleezza Rice. Now, before a few words about Dr. Rice, who honestly is just about the coolest person I've ever spoken with for over an hour, I'd like to thank each of you for helping me get here. I can't tell you how much satisfaction and joy this podcast has brought me. Part of the beauty of making this series, personally speaking, is that because we're not sponsored or taking outside advertising, there's little downside to the process. That is, if only five people ever listen to a single episode, I still have the great luck to talk with some of the most fascinating and extraordinary people on Earth. I mean, I have no business talking to Condi Rice. Are you kidding me? Or Jamie Dimon or Bob Iger. I mean, it's not like I call them up on the weekends just to chat. And to really talk to these people deeply about what matters most at the end of the day. It's been a great thrill. Up to now, as you've been following, our guests tend to come from the highest ranks of business, finance, and government. You might call it the CNBC crowd. For season three, we're going more mainstream by taking a dive into a world I spent 20 years of my life in professionally. Hollywood. Okay, now, this is Coffee with the Greats. And in keeping with the status of past greats, this town, well, it's not short on living legends. But true to the original format of this podcast, which has been described to me as creating an audio portrait of each guest, I'll be sitting down with movie stars and pop stars, Oscar winners, directors, even mega TikTok influencers. It is, at this very moment, a whole new Hollywood. So when season three begins, you might want to listen with a pair of sunglasses on. It's going to be big and bright. But the main event is here, folks. Get ready to be entirely charmed by Dr. Condoleezza Rice, who is among the most distinguished diplomats, political scientists, and professors alive today. Born in the 1950s in Birmingham, Alabama, Dr. Rice shares with us her upbringing under two extraordinary parents. How an intense focus on figure skating snapped her out of being a procrastinator. How the great classical music composers taught her sublime melodies through the piano, but it was a long-winded Protestant preacher who taught her how to improvise the notes when playing. We speak about her wide-ranging career in service of multiple U.S. presidents and alongside many famous foreign heads of state. She shares with us how she trained her mind to be a decision maker amidst complex circumstances and what she values most in leaders. We even touch on what new kinds of national service could look like for the next generation of Americans. I'm just excited for you to enjoy hearing a very personal and genial side to one of the greatest civil servants our country has produced. As always, thank you for listening. If you like what you're hearing, check out earlier episodes for in-depth personal conversations with the likes of Mike Milken, Roger Staubach, the Winklevoss twins, and many more. And subscribe if you haven't already. Give us 5 stars. That helps others discover the podcast. We're taking a break after this one as we produce season 3. But for now, brew up a fresh cup of that Bixby coffee and enjoy this episode of Coffee with the Greats with Dr. Condoleezza Rice.
I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. I was born into the segregated South. My mom was a school teacher. She taught English and later on science. As a matter of fact, one of her students was Willie Mays. My father had multiple jobs. He was a guidance counselor at the high school. He was a Presbyterian minister on the weekend, and he coached basketball and football as well. So he was one of those people who had several jobs. But they were both educators, and I think that's the way to think of them. They were both educators.
John and Angelina Rice. And so he was a Presbyterian minister only on the weekends, but your mother, I gather, was Methodist originally?
Originally Methodist, and she and her sister actually played for Baptist churches because they said the Baptists paid better. But they were Methodist. And of course, when my mom and dad married, my mother became Presbyterian like my father. Well, I was brought up in the Presbyterian Church.
As was I. And I once heard you tell a story about you were asked to play piano almost out of nowhere in the grocery store. And it was a gentleman who was very inspired, but would just go into his sermons and expected you musically to match him. And it was a bit confusing originally.
Yes, well, there are two kinds of musicians. There are musicians who play by the score and read music. And then there are musicians who are really capable of improvising and kind of hearing it and playing by what we say, playing by ear. And kind of just a little interesting side fact, for many, many years, going back into the 18th century, pianists were both. So Mozart was able to obviously read notes, but he could also improvise brilliantly. Well, somewhere along the way, that division took place. And I am one of those people who reads the music. I can play almost anything that you put in front of me. My mother, on the other hand, could read, but she was also a very fine improvisational musician, which you need to be in the Baptist Church, not in the Presbyterian Church where we stick to the school, but in the Baptist Church. And so I was had fallen a little bit away from going to church when I moved out to California. And I was in the spice aisle of the Lucky supermarket. And a man walked up to me, a black man, and said he was buying some food for his church picnic. And he said, do you play the piano? And I thought, wow, yes, I play the piano. And he said, well, you know, our church needs somebody to play. Would you come play? And I thought, okay, the long arm of God into the spice aisle at the Lucky supermarket as they get back to church. And so I played for this church for about 6 months. But in the Baptist church, the minister does what's called raising a song. So he just starts singing and you're supposed to sort of pick up. Well, for my mother, this would have been no problem. For me, as one of those musicians who plays by the music, this was very hard. So I called my mother for advice. And I said, Mother, the problem is that he starts in no known key and expects me to find him. And she said, honey, play in C. He'll come right back to you. And she was right. If you play in C, somehow everybody comes back to it. So that's my story. About six months later, I decided I'd find a good Presbyterian church, and I did.
Well, can we come back, Pondi, to your upbringing here? What disciplines did your parents impose on you or teach you from the earliest age, and how?
Well, it's important to understand that growing up in segregated Alabama, in really a neighborhood that was quite extraordinary in that I think everybody taught school. I think there was one lawyer, one doctor, everybody else taught school. So it was a professional class neighborhood. And it was all about faith, family, and education. And education was kind of the holy grail, because if you were educated, then nothing could touch you, including the horrors of segregated Birmingham. We were told you have to be twice as good. Which meant that we worked twice as hard and now we were twice as confident. They didn't say that, by the way, as a matter of debate or, oh, isn't it too bad that you have to? They said you have to be twice as good. They also said there are no victims, that if you think of yourself as a victim, then you have given control of your life to someone else. And you may not be able to control your circumstances, but you can control your response to your circumstances. And so I grew up in a community that was very disciplined about studying and about that's piano lessons and ballet lessons and French lessons. And so we were the children of parents who believed in our endless possibilities, even in Birmingham at that time.
And of course, in 1963 and 63, Birmingham, most segregated city in America, Bull Connor, the public safety commissioner, and obviously George Wallace, hardcore segregationists. I've heard you say that also being young in that environment, one thing is you could spot from 100 paces away when somebody underestimated you.
Yes. And in my case, it generally came in the form of wanting to be helpful. That somehow, I'd come from this background. I remember when I first, somebody did a story on me when I first came to Stanford, and fortunately they showed it to me before, which was, up from difficult circumstances. I had to inform them that actually I'm not even the first PhD in my family. My aunt was a PhD in Victorian literature. My entire family was highly educated. And so that's, I think, very often how underestimation helps, particularly if you're an underrepresented minority. It's a kind of assumptions about what you have done, who you are, what your capabilities are. And the saddest thing about it is that people are often trying to be helpful and they're trying to be nice, and basically they're just being patronizing. So I can always spot that. I've often said I'd rather confront a dyed-in-the-wool true racist than somebody who's trying to be nice and is ending up being patronizing. We moved to Denver when I was 12. It's kind of an interesting story, speaking again of parents. My parents were both going to graduate school, but this was in the early on. They couldn't go to the University of Alabama, which was segregated. So you will find that many Blacks of their generation went to school, to graduate school in the Midwest or in the North. Uh-huh. And in our case, my father, who wanted to get into college administration, wanted to do a degree in student personnel administration. And the University of Denver had such a degree. And we would pack up the family car from the time I was six. We would drive to Denver. They would go to school because my mom decided that even though she was a fine musician, she wasn't actually certified to teach music in the school. So she was going to get certification to teach music. He was going to do this degree. What to do with me? Well, we tried day camp, but that involved horses. That didn't work out very well. And so we were passing the skating arena one day, and I said, I want to be a figure skater. I think I'd probably watch the Olympics or something. And it was perfect. They could drop me at the rink at 8 a.m, pick me up at 5 o'clock in the evening. It was sort of high priced childcare. And that's how I started ice skating. We would then go back to Alabama, no rinks. I would practice on the floor, whatever. We'd go back the next summer. And finally, the summer when I was about to be 12, my dad decided he wasn't going to finish going two courses every summer. And so he took a leave of absence. He was by then dean of students at Stillman College, took a leave of absence. We went to Denver for what was supposed to be 1 year. And he was offered a job at the University of Denver, and we never went back. So I ended up going to high school in Denver, as well as college, where my dad was a senior administrator.
You skated, you continued to skate through high school. You still skate.
I competed. I was a competitive skater all the way up through my sophomore year in college when it finally occurred to me that I was not that great and it was not an adult sport and I should find something else that didn't make me get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go skate.
Do you still skate?
No, I have not been on the ice in 25 years and I haven't even been to Target. Golf is safer.
I understand, Dr. Rice, when you were in high school, at least initially, I've heard you kind of self-identify initially as a procrastinator.
Yes.
And that because of the rigors, frankly, just of practice, and ice skating and French lessons and piano lessons, that you figured out what a difference in the world it makes to schedule.
Yes, because I say this all the time to young people. You have to at some point have a little conversation with yourself about what's holding you back and what's making life more complicated than it has to be. And I was actually a very good procrastinator in that I could read the book the night before and get an A on the exam. So I kept getting rewarded for it. But the truth of the matter is that to practice the piano 8 hours in one day doesn't give you the same result as practicing 1 hour for 8 days. And so I had to learn to schedule, because by scheduling, you don't waste time. And to this very day, I think I can use 15 minutes better than anybody in the world, because I'll figure out something that I can do with that 15 minutes while I'm waiting for somebody to pick me up for dinner. Well, maybe I can fix that little part of the Chopin F minor ballade that's been worrying me. So yes, I became a scheduler.
And then you said around sophomore year, you stopped skating. I gather it was sophomore year that you also went to the, was it the Aspen School of Music?
Aspen Music Festival School, yes.
And realized that perhaps you might not have the stuff to be performing at Carnegie Hall.
I was really good, but I wasn't as good as some of those 12-year-olds. And that was a real epiphany. And I thought, well, I could probably continue in this career. Who knows? Maybe I would have ended up a professor of music someplace. I could have also ended up teaching 13-year-olds to murder Beethoven for a living. And so I decided there had to be something better in life. And I really wandered the wilderness for a little while. I took a course in my junior year in the first quarter in English literature. I thought, well, maybe that's it. My aunt was an English literature professor. And I thought, no, that's not it. Really don't like English literature. So second quarter, state and local government. And my little project is to interview the city water manager of Denver, to this day, the single most boring man I have ever met in my life. And I thought, okay, that's not it. And fortunately, I wandered into a course in international politics taught by a Soviet specialist, a man named Joseph Korbel, who's Madeleine Albright's father. And I knew what I wanted to do. And so,
So if I can ask you, it's Joseph Korbel's teaching about the Byzantine Soviet politics, the late 20s in the Soviet Union. And all of a sudden the light bulb's off and you say, gosh, I'm just passionate about this.
Yes, just about exactly like that. Because we're reading this book called The Icon and the Axe by the great historian, former, the late Jim Billington, former also head of the Library of Congress. And it's called The Icon and the Axe, and it's about Russian history from the beginning to the end. And Russian history has just this hard side to it. Mm-hmm. And somehow I was attracted to the politics and to Joseph Stalin's witty and sort of cleverness and how he isolated opposition. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. But as it turns out, what I really wanted to do was the economics of central planning. But everybody told me that economics, and it really wasn't economics, it was politics. And so after doing a master's at Notre Dame on the economics side, I came back and eventually wandered into a PhD program. And I do mean wandered, because I didn't commit to the PhD program until I was already sort of taking the courses.
And were your parents still alive when you made this transition?
Yes.
And, and what did they think?
Well, they first said, when I didn't know what my major was going to be, well, you don't know what you want to do with your life. And I said, well, it's my life. They said, well, it's our money. Could you please find a major someplace because you're running out of time? And but they were fine. You know, my parents were always so supportive. And if I had found what I truly loved, then that was going to be okay with them. And so that's what we did. And they were as supportive as they possibly could be from then on.
And was it while you were pursuing your PhD that you then crossed paths with Brent Scowcroft?
I had finished my PhD. I had come to Stanford. Actually came on a one-year fellowship to Stanford. It was a nationally competed fellowship to take young Soviet specialists, teach them about international security policy, kind of bombs and bullets. And I came to Stanford. It's a little bit of a funny story and a little bit embarrassing maybe for one of Stanford's rivals, in that you could take this fellowship at Columbia, the Rand Corporation, UCLA, which was Southern California, MIT, Harvard, or Stanford. Those were the centers. And I did not want to go back to Southern California. I'd been an intern there. My best friend was dating an MIT professor. We decided she should go to MIT, but we shouldn't go to the same place. My father said, Columbia is in New York. It's dangerous. You're not going there. And Harvard didn't answer my letter. And so Stanford did. Now, Harvard claims that they did. But trust me, they didn't answer my letter.
Well, you're talking to two Harvard alums, and we're embarrassed that you just called. We apologize to your colleagues.
That's why I brought it up.
And yet another misstep and Stanford's gain, including the original bequeathment from Leland Stanford,
exactly,
who I gather offered it to Harvard, and boy, did they blow it.
That's right, because their money was a little too new. Stanford's. The story is that apparently the Harvard president was asked by Senator Stanford, what will it take to build a great university? And he said, $50 million and 300 years. And Senator Stanford said, I have $50 million. It won't take me 300 years.
Right, he was.
General Scowcroft.
Yes.
And I'm always interested in what people you learn from leaders.
Yes.
So what was the most valuable thing that he imparted to you?
Just to finish the story, he met me when I was a young faculty member here at Stanford and started taking me to the Aspen Strategy Group and all of these places that the foreign policy people went. He was a real mentor to me. But he taught me most of all how to be a public servant. Brent was incredibly humble, didn't seek the limelight, was somebody who could deal with conflict, but in a way that brought everybody along, but didn't sacrifice principle. He was just a gentle man, and yet one, I think, the most respected national security advisor in our history. So he really, to that matter, George H.W. Bush, you know, it was a generation that where honor and being genteel and dignity were expected of public leaders. And I feel very fortunate to have served with them and for them.
Hey, it's Miles. You know, this podcast is called Coffee with the Greats because I think we have pretty great guests, but also because I love coffee. I've been drinking it every morning of my adult life, and I've learned two things. One, you can't make fresh coffee from stale beans. And two, running out of coffee is a horrible way to start the day. So my buddy Remington and I, we created Bixby Coffee Roasters to deliver delicious, fresh roasted coffee right to your door. At Bixby, we're committed to sustainably sourcing only the highest quality Arabica coffee from remote farms around the world. We only roast in small batches, and we ship the same day you order to ensure it's always fresh. We created our coffee club to guarantee our fresh coffee is always in stock and on time at your home. And we hired the nicest people on planet Earth to handle customer service. We've got simple, light, medium, and dark roasts, but we also offer organic and single origin selections. We even make Keurig compatible pods, and our shipping is always free. The truth is, it's because of Bixby Coffee that I'm able to bring you these fantastic fireside chats with living legends. So if you're looking for a way to support the podcast, or if you want to upgrade your morning coffee and give Always Fresh a shot, just go to bixbycoffee.com. That's bixbycoffee.com. Thanks for your support. George H.W. Bush was a very dear friend of my mother's father, who was one of the first Republicans ever elected in Texas and served in the Congress in six terms under five presidents. My father served in public service, my grandfather, and, you know, my whole life, really, up until very recently, every decision from where I went to high school and in college and what I pursued in the years after was, will this one day help me get elected to public office? And unfortunately, I find that the incentives for the best and brightest have never been lower to run for public office. I've also found that the real doers are usually not elected officials. But as I see it, Americans really used to know each other much better. National service, military, or religious institutions, and you serve, you get to know people who are not like you. Seems like we really have a cultural crisis in America. And I know you've spoken about some form of mandatory public service. Where does one even begin to make inroads there?
Well, there's a movement afoot to try to get at least voluntary national service, where we would have maybe you think of all the gap years that students take on their way to college. Maybe that's a time to spend some time in national service. I am going to say, I hope you don't give up forever on possibly running for office. You know, we don't get good people to run. We kind of get what we deserve. And there are a lot of good people in public service, but we have to keep filling the tank, so to speak. But back to national service. I was really struck in 2016 with the Trump victory, and it was almost as if colleagues here at Stanford and other elite institutions needed to go on an anthropological dig to understand their fellow citizens. You know, the Vance book, Hillbilly Elegy, was the hottest selling item. I literally hear people say, you know, I think I'll try to go to Alabama and see what those people think. And I said to them, you know, if you have to treat your fellow citizens like archaeology, then maybe or anthropology, maybe you ought to think about getting to know them for real. And I think the problem is, as you mentioned, we just don't have very many common experiences any longer. The military is increasingly a class of people who serve, not across classes. We don't live in the same neighborhoods. Increasingly, we don't go to the same schools. One of the things that I've been very much an advocate of is parental choice, school choice, Because if I look at our educational system right now, our K-12 system, we actually have a choice system. If you have means, you will move to a district where the schools are good and the houses are expensive. That's a choice. If you have real means, you'll send your kids to private schools. That's a choice. So who's actually failing in failing neighborhood schools with no way to get out of them? Poor parents. And so we don't go to the same schools anymore. It's just as if we're losing touch with our own citizenry, our own common citizens. And I think if you could get people in national service to go spend a year in some place they would otherwise never have been, or with people they would otherwise never have met, that maybe we'll start to get to know each other again.
So I'm wondering your thoughts on social media and how it exacerbates this cleavage. And again, we're trying to get young people to listen to these podcasts. What would you recommend to them to make sure they keep their horizons open?
Listen to somebody who doesn't agree with you. The problem with social media, and for that matter, the internet, is that it allows you to refine access to your tribe or your clan, and to filter everything else out. So you can go to your websites, your bloggers, your podcasts, your cable news, and you actually never encounter anybody who thinks differently. And I find that if you, with people who do that, you know, eventually if you encounter somebody who thinks differently, you think they're either stupid or venal. And so you really have to get outside of your comfort zone in this way. I say to my students all the time, if you find yourself constantly in the company of people who say amen to everything you say, find other company. Because I do think that we've started to just be in our own little echo chambers. And that way you don't have to hear things that are hard to hear. You don't actually have to construct an argument. Another thing that I tell my students is that I value their opinion, but not their uninformed one.
Yes.
And, you know, just because you think it, it may not be so. And so we are getting lazy about the importance of discourse.
And I find also, you know, not even, you said listen to people who don't agree with you, just to listen in complete sentences. The internet is extraordinarily good at cutting out context.
Yes.
And so this, the idea of even a long form conversation like this, that life is not black and white, there's nuance to opinions. And that matters. But to echo on what you were saying earlier, and kind of the surprise of when the last administration was voted in, you know, this sense that elites are against you, that elites are looking down at you, that globalization is against you, and institutions are not for you. And I've heard you talk about, you know, one thing populists need to do is create an other, and how right now automation is not an other. It's literally not human. So we have this tremendous polarization where everybody's shouting and nobody's listening.
It's a problem that many societies have seen. I really never really quite, I thought I'd see it in America, because we had this common narrative that it didn't matter where you came from, it matters where you're going, you can come from humble circumstances, you can do great things. And even if you weren't doing all that well, you expected that your kids were going to do better. And there was a kind of constant sense of possibility and upward mobility. And one of the things that we probably missed, those of us who believed in globalization, and I would consider myself one of those people, I think that the system that was set up after World War II, that we'd have free trade, that way you would have an international economy that was growing. It wasn't zero sum where my gain was your loss and vice versa. All of those things were very good. But somewhere along the way, we forgot, as people who believe in globalization, that some people got left out. They aren't crazy to think that elites didn't value their values and their culture. They aren't crazy to think that they've been pushed aside. Now, most of them think they've been pushed aside, of course, by immigrants, when really they're being pushed aside by automation. But you can't tell the unemployed coal miner in West Virginia that this is all just really good for you because you can buy cheap goods at Walmart. And so somehow we missed that, and populists then prey on it. And they do create the reason that you're not doing well. And the reason you're not doing well is that other. That's the way that populists do. And by the way, going back to the question about social media, populists of all ages going back hundreds of years would have given anything for social media because it allows you to disintermediate the media, institutions, the government, and speak directly to your adherents. And that's a new capability that I think populists of all ages would have loved with that.
It also itches this new sensation I found. I have had luck making big viral videos on the internet recently have made some that get tens of millions of views. And in, you know, the excitement around it, people will say, now you got to put out another one. Now it's got to get even more. It's a supernatural impulse, but just one step below that, you just think, why? For what? And of course, I'm in the entertainment business. I mean, honestly, these are empty calories. This is not policy, but it's a real itch. And you just want to put stuff out. And then and the emotions internally, it seems like it's a whole new precedent. I remember I will soon be 38 next week, but I remember the iPhone only came out.
I mean, really, that's just so old. What are you going to do? My goodness. I was recently at Notre Dame in 2019, I was on sabbatical and I was actually teaching in the Midwest and I taught at a couple of places, Michigan and Notre Dame and DePaul and Purdue. And one of the really interesting conversations that I had with a group of faculty there was, what this iPhone and the way that people get their information now, what the generation actually miles below you, how they get that information, what that does to their learning, to their patterns of learning, to their synapses, to the way that they engage. And I think that's going to be very interesting work to be done because it's got to be different. I even think back to when Richard and I were in school, you know, if you were about to research a paper, you would go to the Dewey Decimal System of Classification. You would find where in the library those books were. You would then go to the stacks. You would wander through. You would find the books. Who knew what else you might find? So you'd maybe spend some real time in the afternoon kind of browsing around those books. Well, now my students just Google it. And it's fast food information.
Yes.
And it's hard to get them to see that they may be getting breadth, but they're not getting depth by doing it that way. And so there will be, I think, study after study about how different this generation is, and particularly the ones for whom the internet and the iPhone, that they were born into that world.
This is something I taught a course at the University of Texas at Austin. And always worried about whether people are coming up with their own thoughts or just plagiarizing other thoughts or taking from others and not thinking.
Yeah.
And I worry now that this may be, again, exacerbating that tendency.
I think it is. One way that I teach a class to kind of counteract that is I was teaching a course in American foreign policy for 25 students. I chose them from 160 students, a mix of graduate and undergraduates, but they read 500 pages every week. They wrote a 5-page paper every week. I read 25 5-page papers every week, very intense class. But one of the things that I did was that they had to choose to make an argument, and they had to make that argument themselves. And then they also had to tell me why they would discount alternative explanations for that. And trying to get them to engage material in that way so that it's not just I repeat whatever I've just read. And I was teaching them to be skeptical of what they had read. We'd look at an argument and I would say, does that argument really stack up if I ask the following questions? I think we have to teach in that way now because the fast food character of information is really drowning out both depth and the ability to be really analytical.
An incredible productivity can come from boredom. I mean, I music's a big part of my life. I've also performed all over the world and was a singer in guitar. It's because of boredom. I feel like because of the Google machine, the infinite answer box, there's no, you know, when I was young and I asked my older brother, who's 7 years older, a question, hey, how does this work? He would say, kind of smart alecky, I don't know, look it up. And that journey that you talk about going to just the memory retention from that process. And then you get excited and you just start noodling around on a piano or guitar. I find boredom is gone and mystery is gone. And to quote Teddy Roosevelt, comparison is the thief of happiness. And what the new current paradigm of social media is doing is it's training, it's literally training young humans to compare our interiors to others' exteriors visually.
And yes. And in even more damaging, I think, Miles, my minister gave a sermon on the, what do you call the 10 commandments of the digital age. And the first commandment was, don't compare your real life to someone else's virtual life.
Yes.
And if you think about the, you know, Instagram or Facebook, the pictures of you and your friends are always perfect. And it's, you know, life is always great. And the pressure to live up to that virtual life of your friends, I think is actually quite significant for young people these days.
I want to ask you about, this is sort of personal development, but you have done almost everything, Gandhi. I mean, when you think about it, not just being Secretary of State, not just serving on corporate boards, not just being the provost initially of Stanford and now where you are at Hoover and all the things you've done, not even having a super tanker named after you, by the way. And you're an accomplished pianist. I know you don't want, you're not professional, but you played for the Queen and you played for others. And you also are a pretty good golfer because I did play around with you and Rex Tillerson at, yes. at Pebble Beach. Yes. Don't you have to pinch yourself every now and then to say how lucky you've been? And tell us about how you've dealt with this just to keep yourself you.
Yeah, all the time. I just, I'm so grateful. And, you know, I'm a religious person. And so I try never to fail to just thank God for my good fortune and to ask that I can try to be a light to other people in the way that there were those who were that way to me. Because I do think for me, it has affirmed that America is a place of endless possibility. I've had a lot of very lucky breaks along the way. I've worked hard, but I've also had some serendipity in my favor. And so it is the way that you stay yourself, though, is that you always remember that there are many who were just as smart, just as capable, who didn't get those opportunities. And of course, if you have friends who've known you forever, which I do, they don't really care what you did. You're just their friend or their, you know, I have a very close knit, extended family, with cousins. I'm an only child, but my cousins were like my siblings. And, from their point of view, you know, I'm just Condoleezza, not even Condi, because in the South, I'm still called Condoleezza. My mother did not like for people to shorten my name. So the family respects that. So I think if you keep people around you who keep you grounded, and it also means in leadership that you have to be sure that there are truth tellers around you. You know this, that the higher up the ladder you go, it's not that people want to lie, but they want to fix things before they come to you and then it's too late, or they don't want to give you bad news. And you have to have people around you who are going to say, you know, you're really off base here, or this is not good. I remember one example when I was provost. I was, of course, the budget officer at Stanford, and I was really young. I was 38 years old. I'd never been a department chair. I'd never been, let alone a dean. And I was pretty... I was kind of a firebrand, and we were having this budget presentation by the medical school, and the senior associate dean said, I asked him a question, and he said, well, you just don't understand medical school budgeting. And I said, in a quite large room, I think there were probably 20 people in the room, I said, you know, I speak three languages. This isn't in any of them. Would you like to start over? And he was quite taken aback. And after the meeting, though, a friend of mine, more senior professor, said, you know, he said, that was really effective, but it wasn't very smart. He said, because pretty soon, he said, you put him down in front of everybody. Now, nobody's going to tell you the truth. People are not going to risk that kind of put down. And so pretty soon, you'll find yourself just being told what you want to hear. And I thought, know, having people who will say that to you, just really important to have people like that in your life.
Of course, Dr. Rice, you were in the White House on September 11th, but I'm interested actually in speaking for a moment about, you were also in the White House on 11/9, yes. When the Berlin Wall came down. And Dad, I think you were at the Hassler in Berlin at that time. I mean, you saw it with your own eyes. Dr. Rice, you've said, of course, what an extraordinary moment and the end of the Cold War, et cetera, but that day took place because of policies that were implemented 40 years prior. Can you share a little bit with us that moment and kind of where you were in your professional career? I mean, what an extraordinarily exciting chapter in your life.
Yes, and one that has a slightly embarrassing nature to where we were. So we were working really hard in the office of the NSC Directorate for Soviet East European Affairs. We had refugee problems. We had issues with the Soviet Union. We were trying to, it was just 16 hours a day. And so we're there doing something and the phone rings in the office. And it's Brent's secretary who says, the general wants you to come over and brief the president on what's going on in Berlin. And we said, what's going on in Berlin? And she said, turn on CNN. And sure enough, that's how we found out that the wall was coming down, because we were too busy with other things to notice this little event. So when it happened, though, it was just such an incredible moment. You know, remember that I was a specialist on the Soviet Union. I'd done language training in the Soviet Union. I can remember my first time crossing Checkpoint Charlie and ending up in East Germany, and those East German guards who looked like they would shoot you just as soon as they would look at you, and the kind of terror of leaving the Soviet Union once off flight with my two friends, and the plane being forced down in Poland, and waiting to find out what was going on, and cheering when we finally took off. And so the Cold War was personal to me. I had experienced so much of the way that those authoritarian systems operated. And so to see the wall come down, yes, it was quite a moment. I'd studied it, I'd seen it, and now to be a part of the team that was going to try to deliver on that final bargain for the unification of a democratic Germany, it was quite remarkable.
Well, that, of course, happened on Helmut Kohl's watch. There were others who had worked for quite some time. I'm curious, other than our own leaders, George H.W. Bush and others, George W. Bush or any other U.S. leader, who impressed you most amongst foreign leaders?
Oh, without a doubt, Nelson Mandela. And he just had this way about him and this visage that you just knew that this was such a wise man. He came to see President Bush, and I said to President Bush that, you know, he doesn't agree with us on the Iraq War. Maybe you can talk about the AIDS relief program. He's very, very pleased with you for doing that. And so, of course, President didn't listen. He looks right at him. He says, so why didn't you run for another term? And Mandela his head went back and he started to laugh. And he said, I wanted my African brethren to know it's okay to step down. And I thought, you know, what a great lesson, what a great moment. And of course, the reason he was so impressive was this is a man who spent 27 years in jail. And when he was released, and when black South Africans were now in the majority, it wasn't his view that they ought to now oppress the white minority. It was his view that he wanted to build a multi-ethnic, multiracial South African. I mean, speaking of golf, Ernie Els, the South African golfer, said that when Mandela died, it was as if his own father had died. And this is a white South African. And so that kind of wisdom and that kind of seeing the world as it should be, not as it is, he was just head and shoulders above almost anybody else I ever met in that regard.
Well, Miles, I want to talk for a minute about Nelson Mandela. You can erase what I'm about to say, because this is about Dr. Rice. But Gandhi, I served in the Clinton administration as deputy USTR, cutting through the White House one day. Suddenly the president yells out my name, President Clinton. And he said, I want you to sit down with this man, because wasn't your mother a South African from a Norwegian outpost in the Orange Free State how Clinton remembered this, I had no idea. The man was Nelson Mandela.
Oh, my goodness. So
we sat down and he said, you know, was she a Swede? Was she a Norwegian? Was she a Dane? And I said, well, they were Norwegians. He said, well, I know Jagersfontein because they would hide me when I was stirring the ANC. So we sat there and talked, just the two of us, with the president looking over my shoulder. And Madeleine Albright standing behind, totally steamed, that this deputy, not a cabinet member, but Mandela was spending half an hour with me just talking about South Africa. He was a saint. He was a lovely, lovely,
unbelievable, what an amazing
exemplary story. Human being.
Yes.
Anyway, you can erase that, Miles, but I wanted to share that.
Fantastic.
Right.
And actually, as an academic, the example of him stepping down, was it the Roman Cincinnatus? Was it the Roman farmer Cincinnatus who was the first to step back
from kind of being?
That's
and,
right.
And you know, I thought to myself that day, boy, South Africa is really fortunate to have Mandela in the way that the United States was fortunate. First presidents matter, and that George Washington didn't want to be king. Actually, didn't even want to be president the second time around. They had to practically kidnap him and bring him back. And so these men for whom power was not absolute and where they wanted to and understood the need to transfer power, just incredibly important for democracy.
May we just do some quick rapid fire? Because I'd love to know kind of just your day. How do you wake up and what do you like to have done kind of before you leave the house?
I wake up at 5:15. I exercise at 5:30. I either do my own workout or I have a trainer twice a week, Pilates once a week. That's how I start my day. I then read, and I read all newspapers online. I read the newspapers.
But do you exercise without eating anything? Are you a coffee person? Do you drink a smoothie?
Usually without eating anything, maybe a handful of almonds if I want. But I then go have my coffee, read the newspapers, get dressed and leave the house. But the first thing I do is I work out. I actually really love to work out.
Me too. Me too. And obviously for a long time.
How long do you work out? I'm sorry.
I work out depending on which I'm doing. If it's lifting or Pilates, it's an hour. If it's I have a bike, Peloton bike, and I also do elliptical. That'll be more like 50 minutes.
Great. And then you go to work.
And then I go to work.
And have you kept roughly the same to-do system for most of your adult life? Obviously technology, but do you have a piece of paper where these are prioritized stack?
I've just always been, that's sort of the way my day always started, the way that I kind of went through things. Remember, I was a figure skater. You had to be on the ice at 5 o'clock in the morning because the ice was cheap at 5 o'clock in the morning. And so I got used to this kind of pattern and rhythm, and I like the early morning. You will not find me doing much after about 9 o'clock. I'm also an early to bed kind of person.
Do you write things down before you go to bed that you're going to deal with the next day, or it's all up here?
I watch junk television before I go to bed.
Good example. What?
Like HGTV.
Yeah. I'm all about HGTV. And also, I'm a big golfer as well. I love watching the LPGA.
Yeah, I love watching the LPGA. And I have a couple of former students who are on the LPGA, so I follow them as well.
Now, Dr. Rice, do you ever set up a random golf match? Yeah. How do you, like, you're very in demand and you're very busy, but do you ever just walk to the tee box of your club and play with whoever there? It must all be arranged.
You know what? I have regular kind of golfers that I golf with. So there are about six of us, and we're on our way to a group of us, all girls, to Bandon Dunes.
It's a hard
heaven.
Have you played Bandon Dunes? It's hard.
It's hard, but we love it there. And, you know, it's all golf all the time because, you know, it's in the middle of nowhere. So the only thing you're going to do is play golf. So right. I generally play with friends rather than kind of randomly. Yeah.
Other than your own, what is the book that you like to give that kind of yields the most universal appreciation and results? If one or two books.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm a big fan of biography. And so I very often pass on biographies that I really enjoyed. And my very favorite biography is the Chernow biography of Alexander Hamilton. Mm-hmm. I am a Hamilton fan, not so much a Jefferson fan. I'm a Hamilton mm-hmm. fan. And he was sort of quintessentially American, you know, born in the Caribbean of questionable heritage. This sort of very, very aggressive, you know, the full faith and credit of the United States of America. You put it that way. Wouldn't have probably had a treasury without him. And I'm just a big fan. So I very often pass on biographies of people that I enjoy reading about.
I'm a person of faith, and a lot of my mentors, I went to a school with saint in the title all throughout, and the reverends and the pastors were my teachers and my mentors, and I love a good sermon, and I really love good music, but you've got to try a few on for size.
Yes.
How would you encourage a young person as they're transitioning into adult to again, to dip their toe in the waters of maybe going to church or temple?
I would say, remember that we're all spiritual beings in one way or another. We're not actually just a bunch of atoms, it turns out. And we're always seeking meaning. Human beings are always seeking meaning. That great Viktor Frankl book, Man's Search for Meaning, is really true. And so I would say to young people, I'm not going to try to make you a believer. I just want you to give it a chance that you might be. And go to a place where they will engage you. One reason that I love the Presbyterian Church is they'll engage your mind, not just your emotion. My father's church elders told him once, Reverend, you make us think before you let us feel. He said, I'm not sure that was a compliment. I said, Daddy, I think it is a compliment because you were supposed to love the Lord with your mind as well as your soul. And so... I would say go to a place where they allow you to ask hard questions about faith, hard questions about religion, hard questions about the history, and try it on for size. But just get started trying, because there's one thing I will say about the church. It's had its ups and downs. It's done a lot of things for which none of us should be proud. But it's very often people of faith who step into the breach when there is a need for compassion or a need for help for those who are less fortunate. And I think that's there's a reason for that, because yes. I think it's a part of the search for meaning. Now, it was really fun. And let's come play. I didn't catch it, Miles. Are you a golfer too?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. It's quite a passionate one. I was just at Bandon, and this year we're going to Pinehurst for our big trip.
Right. Okay. But so here's an invitation, and you're not random people. Here's an invitation. Come out and play. Out here, and we'll tee it
up. Thanks for listening to another great episode of Coffee with the Greats. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to this podcast so that the next episode will appear magically on your phone when it comes out. And check out Bixby Coffee to discover a better way to brew at home. Use code GREATS for 30% off your first order and free shipping at Bixby Coffee. BixbyCoffee.com